Hello and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. We begin today's program in Papua New Guinea. A major national broadband transmission network is planned for PNG. It is going to be built by the Chinese company Huawei, which is one of the larger technology companies in China. It is set to significantly increase the country's connectivity, but there are also hopes that PNG is being cautious with the level of expenditure and borrowing that is entailed in enduring this kind of arrangement. Paul Barker is from the Department of National Affairs, and he speaks next to Johnny Blades.
We're still largely dependent upon a very old, almost at capacity fiber optic cable to Australia, and the new, not heavily used fiber optic cable out of Guam, which has now been connected to the north coast and through to the highlands finally. So it's working its way through PNG. Now, this new proposal would link up with a connection proposed through to Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, and across the Pacific, and as well as really building up that domestic infrastructure, as it were, for wholesale delivery of internet access, which then can be redistributed by the different service providers. So that's the sort of the background, and obviously the government's core company that was only set up early in the year, PNG Data Co., which is partly evolved out of little offshoots of telecom and so on. It's the provider of this sort of backbone service, and it's come in with this partnership or contractual arrangement with Huawei, yep. Who, of course, is a massive provider of telecommunications services.
Huawei say that the new network will connect via Jayapura in Indonesian territory as well. Is that a good thing?
Well, for sure. I mean, the more interconnections that PNG can be linked up with, frankly, the better. I mean, obviously, yes, there are some concerns that, yes, you've got a Chinese state-owned corporation running this, and we know that the United States has restricted Huawei from some of their major internet provision, but other countries, including the UK and others in Europe, have accepted them as a highly competitive, price competitive and technically proficient corporation, and have been happy to open the doors up to them. So I don't think PNG certainly may have concerns if they had an exclusive control, but certainly PNG would be missing out on the opportunities that they're able to provide if it imposed undue restrictions.
Can the government afford this at this time? I mean, mind you, it is something which obviously an important investment in the country's own growth and future anyway, so it would seem to be sensible, but can it afford it at this time?
Well, that's a good question. It's obviously to some extent dependent on the way the whole thing's structured as a commercial borrowing. Clearly, the recent tie-in through to the highlands and through to the network that Exxon has established, and Exxon and partners established from the highlands down to Moresby, and the expansion by Dataco from the Guam through from Lae, linking using some of the towers that the PNG Power has to link through to the highlands. That's helped increase capacity when that's fully functional through to the Guam fiber optic cable, which, as I say, is only about a fraction of its capacity is in use. So, yes, the importance of the connection to these Solomons and Fiji fiber optic cable, maybe that's not so critical. But, we should be cautious at the level of expenditure and the level of borrowing that is entailed.
That's Paul Barker from the Department of National Affairs in PNG speaking with Johnny Blades about the major broadband transmission network plan for Papua New Guinea. Now, let's talk about content that we share online. This is something actually that's very common. It doesn't matter if you go on Facebook or Twitter. To find content that is shared, well, it's quite rampant. Now, the question is, why do we share news stories with our friends and networks? Is it to be a good citizen or to present a certain image of ourselves to the world? Do we share stories because they are funny or counterproductive or because they bring us to tears? Well, finally, there's some data on what makes us want to send a story out into the wider world. Hal Crawford is the editor-in-chief of 9 MSN in Sydney. Domangia Falavac is the chief executive officer of Viacorp. They both speak next to Richard Ady.
The problem for them was they had a whole bunch of theories and you know, thoughts about how what makes something shareable, but they really needed some hard data. And we decided that we needed to build some sort of software and engine that would actually track, you know, stories across the world and store that data so that we can analyze it.
Okay, so talk me through the nature of that challenge and bear in mind that you are talking to a journalist. Yeah. So
we needed to understand what stories were sharing across the globe. And basically what we did was we started tracking something like 150-odd websites across the globe, all news websites, and tracking each of their stories. And we do this every 20 minutes.
Am I right in thinking that you initially sketched out what you needed to do literally on the back of an envelope?
That's exactly right. So when Hal and I spoke about this first...
Wasn't it a serviette?
Look, it'd be good to nail this down, actually.
And it was quite simple because this data actually exists already out there. Facebook and Twitter publish this information publicly about what news articles are sharing across the world. And it was just a matter of pulling that together in a way that could be accessible and usable and analyzable.
So the initial idea is that you get the RSS feeds from the news websites and the stats from social media, put them into a database, and you had a huge weekend coding. I love the way you built this all in a weekend. And you come up with the likeable engine.
Yeah, so it was one of those inspirational weekends where you had an idea and it just happened. I think that the main part of it was built on the Sunday morning between midnight and 5 a.m. That was an early prototype. I could start actually seeing, you know, that data coming in real time and seeing what was happening in the world, you know, right before my eyes. And that was very exciting. And when I showed it to Hal and Andy the next day, we saw that we had something.
When you first looked at it, you were probably being the only person in the world who would know that information.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in some ways, people at Facebook could get access to that information, but there was no publicly accessible way to see that and easily, you know, visualized.
So you run into problems fairly early on with RSS and you decide that what you're going to do instead is make it a web scraper. Now, this is where I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so basically RSS feeds are kind of a technical way for seeing what articles are on a website. But really, people are seeing all of their content on the front page of a news site. And that's how Google goes and gets its content. It scrapes the home pages of a website and sees what stories are on there. And that's what we decided to do as a better way than RSS feeds. So we got those stories and then basically tracked how many people were sharing or liking those stories on Twitter and Facebook, which gave us a curve that we could graph and actually see, you know, what stories are spiking and, you know, the audience was reacting to.
And how you were able to get this going, well, Don gets it going, and then you kind of unleash it on the world. And after a while, you come up with four principles for what makes content shareable. Basically, shareable stories, there's overlap, isn't there? But they have one or a combination of four qualities.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to describe them as qualities. Any story can possess all of them or, you know, one or two of them. We call it scent, and it's a combination of marketing knowledge as well as the stuff that we observe from this real data from this engine that Don built. Scent stands for simple, emotional, new, and triggered. And, you know, having done surf life-saving training, I know all these acronyms and they help you and it's kind of naff, but they also help. So simple is the ideal for any news story, which is even the most important stories or often the most important stories are simple.
You grasp them straight away.
Right.
And give me an example of... Okay. Of a simple story that...
Yeah, this one's going to... You're going to think, this is going to reinforce all my views about social media. The archetype of the simple story is a penguin wearing a little jumper. And the penguin wearing a little jumper is the most shared Australian story that we know of to date, shared 600,000 times.
Wow.
Yeah. that is about little penguins down in Phillip Island, and when they get oil on their feathers, they lick it off and they get, you know, they die or whatever. Have to keep them warm, have to stop them from licking their feathers, so you need to knit them little jumpers.
Mm.
The particular article that I'm talking about was an appeal for help to knitters that just went off. So totally simple. But other things that are important, you know, more than the well-being of penguins, changes of government, things like very important political stories, stories that are not just speculation, also fall into this simple category.
All right, what about emotional? Because you actually make the point that a physiological response to a story makes us more likely to share it. And we know that because researchers have found that if you make people jog on a machine and then give them a story, they're more likely to share it than if they just stand there and read it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we did do some brainstorming about how we could get people to do physical exercise and then consume our content. Effectively, though, what you want to do is you want to build in that physiological reaction into the content.
Mm.
A lot of people think, oh, that's me getting angry about something. Mm. That's true.
I was going to say, shock, outrage, anger, they're the things that come to mind.
They are, but think also of awe. Think about the hairs on the back of your neck raising up. That is a physiological reaction. And if I can get you to feel like that by, say, making you feel very small in the scheme of the universe, then I can get you to share that piece of content.
Mm. All right. So at the N in sense stands for new information.
New. That's so broad. In fact, of course, what we do is the news. It also encompasses this idea of being unexpected. And I think in the book we give a few examples of the perfectly unexpected story, which is what we call the reverse. The poster child of the reverse is the baby in Indonesia who smokes 2 packs of cigarettes a day.
Man bites dog is the classic.
Oh, sorry, yeah, that is the classic, yeah. And
You actually, I'm glad we got to the reverse because it's sort of reassuring for the old school journos out there, because the reverse has always been, forever, a great story, but it still is, and the data shows it. And also, there must be a trigger to share the information too, yeah?
There must be a trigger of some sort. Triggers is, I suppose, where we get closest to marketing theories of signalling. Triggering is the idea that if something is before you all the time, like breakfast cereal, like disposable coffee cups, they will come to mind more often and therefore you're more likely to share that. How we sort of extrapolate that into news media, I think that's an area we want to explore some more of.
Mm.
But for example, we already know that things that affect a wide range of people are much more likely to be shared. For example, weather phenomena, things that we see every day, you know, why can't we get public transport to work properly? Stuff like this, if it affects a broad range of people, will tend to be shared.
This is the media report on RN, and interestingly, the word report, Hal's and Dom's research found, is one of the least shared words that there is. How it's not just content. You've also found that there are three distinct classes of shared behaviour. There's newsmaking, which is the one that all journalists kind of understand. This is a story, this is new, here you go. Then there's inspiring and teaming. Hmm. So what's inspiring?
I think of those three categories, and these are basically classifications, so every story will fall into one of these slots, not into two. Newsbreaking, I think we get that.
Mm.
Inspiring is probably what people think instinctively when they think of sharing news on social media, if in fact they do think about it. You know, this kid raised $11,000 selling lemonade on the street corner for his dad's cancer operation. It hits you in the gut. It is like, isn't that amazing? Isn't that an amazing element of human nature that the neighbours of these people would come and give this kid so many thousands of dollars to cure his father's cancer? That kind of thing sits in that inspiring box. And we thought, before we did the analysis, before Dom built his engine, we thought that was the heart and soul of sharing. What we discovered, in fact, was that there was a third category.
And this is teaming.
Teaming. And that is, in fact, the heart and soul of sharing.
Two-thirds of it,
yeah,
more or less,
right.
Is teaming. So this is...
Yep.
What is this? Is this about you saying something about who you are in the world?
That's exactly what it is, and it often involves judgment. So it often involves approval or disapproval.
Right.
In all cases, it involves saying, this is who I am, this is what I believe, this is what I want to be identified with.
So if I'm watching the Swans play, I'm a Swans member, and I'm tweeting about how well we're going, that's part of that.
That is. If you, you know, the Adam Goods, so speaking of the Swans, Goods and the whole controversy over the booing of Goods, if you came out and said, in fact, I don't know if you did tweet on Goods or not, but I would expect you to share a story, for example, Stan Grant's piece, which, you know, I think was quite an amazingly good piece. If you shared that, you would be saying, this is my camp. This is what I believe in. This is the way that I want to be viewed and the views that I want to propagate through the world. So you are definitely teaming when you share Stan Grant's piece.
Which I did. So there we go. Dom, I want to bring you back in. We've been talking about the likeable engine like it's done and dusted, but I know that these things are always forever iterated. Are you still tweaking it?
Yeah, absolutely. We are continually making updates to it. I think one of the things that we found was its potential as a journalistic tool is something that is very real. And we do actually have people all over the world that are using the likeable engine. You know, if there's any feedback, we're always interested to find out what kind of things we could improve.
It fits into that emerging ecosystem of getting metrics on this kind of thing. I went to the Guardian Australia's offices a wee while ago and looked at their OFAN system, which gives them real-time feedback on which stories are going well, stories below the fold that seem to be going better than they should be, let's move it up, that kind of thing.
And there are companies making, you know, complete businesses out of this sort of stuff on an ongoing basis. I think when media companies decided to put the like button on all their articles, they kind of lost control to a certain extent of the metrics, and these things are now publicly available and there for everyone to see.
Lost control, Hal. That gets us to, I suppose, the hard questions that you have a look at towards the end of the book. And remember, you're on a program with the word report in its title. Where does it leave us? Because it's easy to think, well, you know, BuzzFeed seems to have this cracked at the moment. Mm. But are we all forever dependent on how well we go on Facebook?
Let's just say yes, we are. But not we are, but it, not because it's Facebook. We're forever dependent on it, and we always were. We just didn't realise it, I think, is the real insightful take on this. For example, I'm presuming even in the days of hot lead, newspaper editors would have wanted something that their audience valued.
Mm.
They were working in an information vacuum. As the information on your audience becomes exposed and you see what your audience is actually doing, everything changes.
What does it mean for what I was taught when I was at journalism school was the BBS? This is the boring but significant story, often on the front page, often contained the word report. It was often about the economy or something like that. It was usually the front page lead in an old-fashioned broadsheet newspaper. And it would have been put there because it was important, but we didn't know then how little read it probably was.
I don't think it is. I think you have to be willing to say that we were wrong in the past. So there were elements of what we did that were wrong. For example, putting that story with the report on the front page lead. If something is worth being on the front page, it is possible to make it interesting. And if it is not possible to make it interesting, get rid of it and get something that is interesting and important, because they are not mutually exclusive. You don't have to have interesting and important and being in separate camps. You've got to do things that you believe in, and you've got to try to make them as popular as they can be. That's how I view it.
How well do you think the editors of Australian publications are getting this?
I think that there is massive resistance to the idea of data, because I think the idea of data is viewed as a master, not as a tool. If the data is a master, it's a very poor master, and we allude to this in the book where, in our time in the noughties, in 9MSN, we would task producers with maximising page views, and they would create diabolical pages, you know, with a rape followed by a murder followed by a bestiality yarn. And that's where the metrics are the master. That's not how you should run it. You've got to inject yourself into the process.
Yes, why do we share stories? That came to us from Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, you are listening, of course, to Media Network Plus. Now, before we get to this week's propagation, just to tell you that the fourth program in our series from the Radio Netherlands Archives is coming up next week. The program will be broadcast on the 30th and 31st of October in UTC time. The program this month, program four, will have the spotlight on Eduard Frans Conradin. Now, some of you are wondering, well, who is that? Well, he was known as Eddie Starts. So program four from the Radio Netherlands Archives will be featuring and talking about Eddie Starts, who began working for Philips Omron Poland Indy in 1927, and then in 1928 he started presenting programs in English, French, and Spanish, including German. And the name Happy Station came from the first words that he spoke in English when he said, "This is Philips Radio, PCJ, your Happy Station," which happened on November 19th, 1928. And on that program, we're going to include some very rare clips from the 1920s and broadcast a full Eddie Starts Happy Station show. Now, the times and frequencies are the following, and these are all in UTC. To Europe, from 6 to 8 hours UTC, that's 6 to 8 hours UTC to Europe, October 30th on 7780 kHz. Then to North America, from 1 to 3 hours UTC, that's 1 to 3 hours UTC to North America on October 31st on 7570. If you put that in local time, that would be, for Europe anyway, a Sunday morning, and for North America, a Sunday evening, but the times, of course, are in UTC. You can find all the details at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. Now, before we get to this week's propagation, staying on from the Radio Netherlands archives, we're now finally getting to the response, the EQSL, for the programs for last month's edition. We've a little bit of a swamp with a few things that we actually have going on, but we are getting those out a little bit late. We apologize for that, but those who did write should be getting them very soon. All right, let's now turn our attention to propagation. What has been happening and what we can expect over the next 7 days? Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through October 22nd, normal to fair at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through October 22nd, magnetic conditions becoming unsettled to active on October 22nd, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through October 23rd, solar activity forecast to remain very low. Quiet levels of geomagnetic activity expected to increase on October 22nd and 23rd, with a 40% chance of minor storm intervals. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on October 21st, November 2nd to 7th. Quiet to active on October 22nd, 26th to 28th, and November 10th. Active to disturbed on October 23rd to 25th, 29th, 30th, and November 1st. Quiet on November 8th and 9th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field activity likely October 22nd to reach G1 minor storm levels on October 23rd, and G2 storm levels October 24th to 26th. Quiet conditions likely from November 2nd to 10th. ANK indices peaking at 35 and 6, October 24th to 26th, as solar flux dips to 70 on the same dates, up to 90 by November 6th. Lowest A's and K's of mostly 5 and 2, November 2nd to 10th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF DX maps call for extreme tropospheric ducting off Baja California Norte the morning of October 23rd, off West Africa to Cape Verde until October 23rd, across the central Mediterranean, off Angola and Namibia, between Oman and India, and off the northwest coast of Australia, all from October 23rd to 25th.
Glenn, I want to ask you, when you recorded that, did you have a bit of a cold? Because you sounded exactly like I did a week ago. Anyway, thanks a lot, Glenn, for this week's propagation. Now, if you have any comments or suggestions that you'd like us to hear about, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. We do have coming up, by the way, another review of a radio. Yes, because you probably are aware, there's a couple of new DRM receivers that have come on the market. We actually got our hands on one of them. And we're going to do a review of that on a upcoming edition of the program. So stay tuned. We've had it for a while, but we're still kind of going through the motions with it. But I think you'll want to tune in. I love DRM. I really love DRM as a technology. That's all I'm going to say right now. Anyway, that's all we have time for. On behalf of the whole team and everyone else here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Doo-Dee-Doo, 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 love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Doo-Dee-Doo, 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 love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Doo.